The Second Amendment wasn't revolutionary, it was evolutionary. While today's heated debates might suggest this right emerged with America itself, the truth stretches back nearly a millennium, predating even our cherished freedoms of speech and religion. What began as a duty in Saxon England gradually transformed into a fundamental right that the Founding Fathers considered their oldest inherited liberty. The 27 words that spark such passionate disagreement today, a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, represent the culmination of centuries of Anglo-American legal tradition. Imagine this, when America's founders debated arms rights, they weren't creating something new, but preserving something ancient they feared might be lost. In early Saxon England, bearing arms was an obligation, not a privilege. King Alfred established a system requiring subjects to serve as soldiers when needed. Freemen joined the army during emergencies, with landowners maintaining weapons appropriate to their rank. These weapons couldn't be sold, lent, or withheld from heirs, as they were essential to national security. This tradition continued after the Norman conquest of 1066. Henry II's Assize of Arms, 1181, required every freeman to possess weapons according to his wealth, from knights with full armor to ordinary freemen with letter protection. The law protected these weapons from confiscation by forfeiture, gift, pledge, or any other manner, establishing arms possession as a right beyond feudal control. Edward I expanded these requirements in 1285, mandating that every man between 15 and 60, not just freemen, obtain weapons according to his means. Even the poorest were required to keep poleaxes and knives. Medieval England, despite its rigid social hierarchy, legally required universal armament of its male population by law. The Tudor era, 1485 to 1603, revolutionized the relationship between citizens and arms through firearms. Initially, Henry VII restricted crossbows in 1503 to preserve England's longbow advantage, not from fear of armed commoners. Henry VIII first mandated longbow practice for all able-bodied men, with children starting at age 7 and cities building ranges. His attempts to limit handguns to wealthy landowners failed. By 1523, he reduced property requirements for gun ownership, and by 1539, repealed gun laws entirely. Firearms became so common that by 1540, Henry complained of reckless shooting endangering citizens in the open street. Queen Mary's 1557 militia statute officially recognized firearms among required arms, with wealthy citizens mandated to maintain weapons, including arquebus firearms. By 1569, firearm ownership was widespread in England, with counties establishing shooting ranges and rewards for marksmen. In a 1570s English village, regular firearms practice was a community activity, a society promoting firearm proficiency rather than fearing armed citizens. From 1639 to 1689, modern Anglo-American arms rights concepts emerged as England evolved from absolute monarchy to constitutional government through civil war, military dictatorship, and revolution, with one king executed and another exiled. After defeating Charles I, Parliament faced crisis when Cromwell's army seized power. The government demanded Londoners list their weapons and authorized searches of anyone deemed dangerous. Charles II's restoration in 1660 established early gun control. Gunsmiths reported all weapons and purchasers weekly, carriers needed licenses, and importation was banned. The 1662 Militia Act declared the king's supreme power over the militia and authorized searches from those dangerous to the peace. The 1671 Hunting Act expanded disarmament beyond political opponents to anyone without substantial property, effectively disarming merchants and middle-class townspeople. Landowners could search homes upon suspicion of gun ownership. This period showed how quickly rights could be undermined through increasingly restrictive regulations, teaching English citizens and later American colonists that rights needed explicit protection to prevent gradual erosion. The Glorious Revolution of 1688 concluded with Parliament offering William and Mary the throne on condition they accept the Declaration of Rights, which protected arms ownership. Parliamentary debates highlighted concerns about arms seizures under the Militia Act, with members denouncing these as an abominable thing to disarm the nation. The House of Lords amended the arms provision to guarantee an individual right rather than a militia duty. The final declaration stated that the subjects which are Protestant may have arms for their defense suitable to their condition and as allowed by law. Parliament further strengthened this right by removing guns from items prohibited to non-hunters in the Game Act. When asked about private arms training, the Recorder of London affirmed that Protestant subjects' right to have arms for their own defense and to use them for lawful purposes is most clear and undeniable. This restoration represented recognition that disarmament had left citizens vulnerable to both tyranny and crime, a lesson that would deeply influence American colonists facing their own struggles against perceived tyranny. In the American colonies, arms ownership existed as a practical necessity, reinforced by militia laws requiring virtually all free males to be armed. Plymouth Colony mandated every freeman provide a sufficient musket, while Virginia required men not work in fields without their arms and bring weapons to church. New Jersey's 1744 militia law specified infantry needed a good musket or fusee well fixed, a bayonet, a cutting sword or cutlass, a cartouche box or powder horn, with ammunition. Cavalry required a good horse, saddle, breastplate, holsters, case of pistols, cutting sword, and carbine. This necessity aligned with Whig political philosophy dominating colonial thinking. John Adams estimated 9/10 of Americans identified as Whigs by the Revolution. Writers like Roger Molesworth defined real Whigs as opposing standing armies while supporting arming and training of all freeholders. James Harrington argued republics with armed citizens were hardest to conquer. Colonial Americans thus inherited both a practical tradition of universal armament and a philosophical framework viewing armed citizens as essential to liberty, twin influences that proved decisive when conflict with Britain erupted. British attempts to disarm colonists in 1774 sparked resistance. General Gage's weapon seizure at Lexington ignited the war, while widespread armament hindered British operations, illustrated when a boy captured a British soldier raiding a widow's garden. After independence, state constitutions recognized arms rights. Virginia established that a well-regulated militia, composed of the body of the people, trained to arms, is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. Pennsylvania declared the people have a right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state. The Constitutional Convention's omission of a Bill of Rights created opposition. Richard Henry Lee insisted, to preserve liberty, the whole body of the people always possess arms. Madison noted America's advantage of being armed against potential federal forces in Federalist No. 46. When drafting the Bill of Rights, Madison placed arms rights alongside individual freedoms like speech. The Senate rejected limiting arms rights for the common defense, suggesting broader individual purposes. The Second Amendment transformed an ancient duty into constitutional right, preserving the core principle that an armed citizenry checks tyranny and enables self-defense throughout Anglo-American legal tradition.